Well, folks, welcome to the Nobleman Podcast. I am so thankful to have Professor Nancy Piercy with us, and we've already chit-chatted a little bit. I know there's a thunderstorm going on where you are in Houston, so we're just going to pray that the Lord keeps that away. But welcome to the Nobleman Podcast, Professor Piercy. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks so much for having me. And by the way, I love that title, the Nobleman.
Well, thank you. And so I've told you a little bit about this. Noble Warriors may be unique in terms of some of your podcast interviews because our focus is helping churches disciple men. And so I am so thankful for this book. It has already been a landmark book. I've shared it with a number of pastors. I've talked about it. I've given it away to some folks. I was listening to a sermon from a pastor in California yesterday, and he mentioned your book on his sermon in September, the Labor Day weekend. So, man, you're making some traction. But let's start off with, tell us, the toxic war on masculinity. Most people talk about toxic masculinity, and you talk about the toxic war. So tell us about the title and the differentiation between those two ideas.
Right. Well, you know, you have to use the words toxic and masculinity because that is the phrase. But I didn't want to use that actual phrase because I do not think masculinity is toxic. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, what was a way to get both words in there without, you know, committing myself to the idea that there is such a thing as toxic masculinity. And so it really was kind of a play on words that I hope maybe would cause people to do sort of a double take, right? And most Absolutely. People say that it did do that. A lot of people misread it the first time. They did read it as Sure. the war on toxic masculinity and had to go back and say, "What? Wait, what?" So I hope it serves its purpose in terms of attracting attention and showing, of course, that I am going to have a very different message.
Awesome. Well, so you say that you don't believe masculinity is toxic. I agree with you. I think masculinity is God's design. I think sin is toxic. So tell us about the war on masculinity being toxic and how that got to be so damaging and dangerous.
Oh, yeah. So I have to tell you, I started to write this book because I did notice how socially acceptable it has become to express incredible hostility against men. One of the articles that caught my eye was in the Washington Post, and it was titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" And I thought, really? In a mainstream publication? A Huffington Post editor tweeted hashtag kill all men. Wow. And you can buy t-shirts that say, so many men, so little ammunition. And even books with titles as blunt as I Hate Men and No Good Men and Are Men Necessary? So that's what caught my eye. And by the way, even some men are jumping on the bandwagon. So there's a fairly well-known male author who wrote a book in which he said, talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer. I just can't believe people talk this way. And you may have seen the most recent one. It's not in the book because it was in the news recently, but, the director of the movie Avatar, James Cameron, was quoted saying, testosterone is a toxin that you have to work out of your system. So this is what got my attention. And I thought, we've got to get to the bottom of this. You know, I write mostly apologetics books, and I consider this apologetics because what I'm doing is I want to get to the bottom of why secular culture gets masculinity so wrong. And then, of course, defend a biblical view of masculinity.
Well, secular culture is getting this wrong because they are, according to some of your research, they're lumping everyone who checks the box for a Christian in one camp. And you've pointed out that there is a differentiation. They're really two different groups of men who might check that box. And so we get this bifurcation, maybe even a barbell sort of graph. So explain the difference between these two groups and how that can cause confusion in our culture.
Right. So many people consider evangelical Christian men exhibit A of toxic masculinity. Right. It was really easy to find examples, but I'll give you just one. So the co-founder of the Church Two movement, which followed the Me Too movement, said this, the theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today. And so what happened is the social scientists were reading these kinds of accusations and saying, where's your evidence? You know, you're making these charges. Where's your data?
Right.
And so they went and did the studies, psychologists, sociologists, and I cite roughly a dozen or so studies where they said, actually, the media narrative has it all wrong. It turns out that committed Christian evangelical men who attend church regularly test out the best. They test out as the most loving husbands and fathers of any group in America. And by the way, they do, interview the wives separately, because I often get people saying, of course, their wives said that, you know, the husband's sitting right next to them. No, actually, right. Most of these studies were taken from these large objective databases. The largest one is called the General Social Survey, and it's done by the University of Chicago. And it's a database that policymakers and journalists and politicians, social scientists all draw from. So the women are in fact interviewed separately. And so what they're saying is the wives report the highest level of happiness with their husband's expression of love and affection. Evangelical fathers spend more time than any other group with their children, both in terms of shared activities like sports, church youth group, and in terms of discipline, like setting limits on screen time or enforcing bedtime. Right. Evangelical couples have the lowest rate of divorce. They are 35% less likely to divorce than secular people. And then the real stunner is they actually have the lowest level of domestic abuse and violence. And so the studies have completely debunked the media narrative. And even Christians don't know this. I had to go digging in the academic literature to find this. And let me give you just one quote, because sometimes a quote can really crystallize it. This is one of my favorite, my go-to sociologist, I call him. He's also one of the best-known, most famous marriage sociologists in the country. His name is Brad Wilcox. He's at the University of Virginia.
You're right here in Virginia.
UVA. And he, to give you a sense of his stature, he writes for places like the New York Times. So this is an article from the New York Times that he wrote. And he says, it turns out that the happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives. And of course, they do focus often on the wives, because the assumption is any sense of male headship turns men into overbearing, oppressive, tyrannical patriarchs. So no, it turns out that the happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives. Fully 73% of wives who hold conservative gender values and attend religious services regularly with their husbands have high quality marriages. And so this isn't just, you know, a pep talk from a religious leader. This is solid empirical research. This is evidence-based findings that we should be bringing into our churches to start with, to help churches to support and affirm men who are doing a good job. But we also should bring it into the public square and be bold about saying, you know, you guys have got it all wrong, you know, debunking the secular narrative. And then I often get a pushback by people who say, but haven't we all heard that Christians divorce at the same rate as the rest of society? In fact, in my research, I found that that was one of the most widely quoted statistics by Christian leaders. So what happened, though, is the researchers went back to the data and they separated out, as you said, they separated out the truly committed Christian men, which they defined primarily by attending church regularly, from men who are just nominal Christians. And by the way, my students don't even know what the word nominal means, so I have to explain. NOM is Latin for name, so it means in name only. So these are men who might, you know, in a survey like this, might check the Baptist box, for example, but they don't actually attend church. It's mostly cultural background, family background. And these men test out shockingly differently. They fit all of the toxic stereotypes. So their wives report the lowest level of happiness with their husband's treatment of them. They spend the least amount of time with their children. They divorce at a higher rate than secular men, 20% higher than the secular culture.
Wow.
And then the real shocker is they have the highest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any major group in America. So this is where the stereotypes or really the statistics get skewed, because if you just study evangelicals, you're going to get men who are better than secular men and men who are worse than secular men. And so, of course, the numbers are going to be misleading. And so this was incredibly helpful Brad Wilcox was the one who did the largest study. So if you want to follow up, that's your sociologist to go to. Well, let me give you a quote. One more. Sure. This is actually my favorite one because Brad Wilcox turns to his fellow academicians, right? Most sociologists, it's a highly secularized field. And he turns to them and he says, academics need to cast aside their prejudices about religious conservatives and evangelicals in particular. Conservative Protestant married men with children are consistently the most active and expressive fathers and the most emotionally engaged husbands. So Christianity really does have the ability to reconcile the sexes, as I put it in the subtitle of my book.
So with that in mind, I don't know that you get into this, but what makes the difference in the lives of those evangelical men? I mean, you said the measure is they go to church consistently, but is there something more than showing up and sitting in a pew on Sunday morning that makes a difference in the lives of these evangelical men?
Well, two answers to that. Surprisingly, church attendance tends to correlate pretty closely with a deep heart commitment. You know, there are studies that have been done trying to tap into, you know, how sincere are they? You know, they'll ask questions like, how often do you pray? Or, you know, how important is your religion? Or do you have a sense of God's presence in your life? You know, there are studies that have done that. And in fact, they haven't found that you get much different output from just asking, do you attend church regularly? And since that is a very empirical, quantifiable measure, they've ended up choosing that as the main measure because it tends to correlate, tends to give you the everything you need. So that was surprising because, I mean, you know, most of us think, yeah, aren't there a lot of people who just sort of show up? But apparently not. Apparently the ones who care enough to show up regularly do, in fact, have that deeper commitment as well. And the second thing I was going to say is I often get asked, why would nominal Christians be worse than secular men? I mean, don't they at least have a little bit of Christianity?
Right.
Wouldn't that help them? Well, it turns out that they are taking words like headship and submission, but not giving them the biblical meaning. Instead, they're infusing or importing meanings from the secular script for masculinity. And the difference between that and a secular man is the nominal man feels like he has religious justification. So the run-of-the-mill secular guy who's maybe mistreating, abusing his wife and children, he doesn't feel that he has religious justification. But the nominal Christian does. He thinks he's got, in a sense, religious permission to act like that. And so he ends up actually being worse than a secular man. So that was one of the most surprising findings.
So those guys become tyrants who read Ephesians 5 and force submission instead of reading the next verses and love their wives as Christ loved the church and invite her on this journey of following Jesus together. Is that a fair way to look at that, perhaps?
So I do have a whole chapter of surveys so that I wanted to see what are real ordinary Christians. How are they living? And what do they think it means to practice headship and submission? I didn't want to hear from the experts, the theologians, you know, the thought leaders, because they can pontificate, you know, they can tell us what they think the Bible means. I wanted to know what real ordinary Christians do. And the reason for that is the secular argument is, you know, if you believe in any sort of male headship, this will turn you into an overbearing tyrannical patriarch. Well, does it? You know, the only way you can find out is by asking actual Christian couples. And so I have a chapter that's just consists strictly of surveys of Christian couples. And I have to tell you, I was blown away. I was surprised. Mm. I did not expect Christian couples to express such a loving, mutual, respectful definition of headship. I mean, if I was surprised, I'm sure a lot of my readers are surprised as well. And the most frequently cited Bible verse was Ephesians 5. You know, husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church. And the interesting thing about that was I have chapters later on abuse. You know, since nominal men have high levels of abuse, I had to deal with that, right? Otherwise it would look like I was sweeping it under the carpet. In that chapter, I quote people who said, I never heard any sermons on the second part of Ephesians 5, you know, husbands, love your wives, I literally quoted one woman who said, I didn't even know that verse was in the Bible. I had to go look it up myself. They had never heard the part in Ephesians addressed to husbands. They had only heard the part addressed to wives. So that tells you something. When you got to the really committed men, they quote the part to husbands. And so right. I thought that was pretty cool. And if you ask them, well, what do you think headship means then? You know, just how are you living it out in your right. life? They did not say final authority. They did not say tiebreaker. They did not say, you know, I forget some of the other things that we often hear. What they did say was spiritual leader. That was the mm-hmm. most widely given definition of what it means to be head. And so then the researchers would say, well, what does that mean? What do you mean spiritual leader?
Right.
And they started with the practical things, like get your family to church on Sunday, get your kids to youth group, have Bible reading and prayer in family devotions at home. But they often went further than that. They went into some more non-tangible things like, well, you know, I'm responsible for my children's spiritual growth. You know, I'm responsible right. for my wife's spiritual welfare. You know, it's up to me. Taking the initiative means, I quoted one author who said, male initiative means you go first. You know, you go first. If you want a rich spiritual life in your home, you go first. You get make sure you have a rich spiritual life. And so you have something to give. You know, if you want your family to be, more responsible in the keeping the house clean, you know, you go first
right.
and then invite them to join you. So it was amazing to me how much evangelical couples communicated a very warm, loving definition of headship.
Well, that's encouraging. But I find it discouraging that some folks had stopped their preaching on Ephesians at the submission part. And so you get the idea that there are some churches out there where this broken picture of what made so toxic, it's toxic right in the church right there in that scenario. I mean, that's probably a bold statement for me to make, but until you tell the whole story of the redemption that comes with Christ, then that's an incomplete message. And I find that frustrating.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, when I do have the chapters on abuse, it's true that committed evangelicals have the lowest rate, but it's not zero. So right. it is true that even sure. some people who attend church regularly are still having difficulties, you know, in addition to sure. the nominal men. And by the way, right. of course, the outcome of that studies is the practical takeaway is we should be, I would like to see churches be more supportive and encouraging to the men who are doing well. Even in Christian circles, men feel, you know, the discouragement, the demoralization of, you know, a culture that says masculinity is toxic. When I told my class I was writing a book on masculinity, a male student shot back, "What masculinity? It's been beaten out of us."
Wow.
And then and another story from my class, I have a graduate student who was the leader of the women's ministry at a large Baptist church here in Houston. And she said, on Mother's Day, we hand out roses and tell the mothers they're yep. wonderful. On Father's Day, we scold the men and tell them to do better.
Right.
And so I thought, well, I tried very hard not to have a scolding tone in this book because I think the church needs to get past that. The church needs to look at right. these numbers and say, men, you're doing a good job. And you asked the question of why did church make a difference? And I didn't answer that one. There is an answer, though. So, we're back to Brad Wilcox. So the sociologist, because mm-hmm. he works in a very secular environment, he finds himself having to explain to his colleagues why church makes a difference. And it's
right.
it's almost comical for you and me because, you know, we do know that church makes a difference.
Right, we did it.
But he has to explain this to people who don't go to church. And even myself, I have a sister who's not a Christian, and she was very skeptical. She said, well, maybe it's a self-selection process. You know, maybe it's not that church helps men be nice guys. Maybe it's that nice guys choose to go to church. To which I say, well, what is it about church then that would attract nice guys?
Right.
But Brad Wilcox tries to explain to his secular colleagues, well, here's what you need to understand. Men do not get a pro-family, pro-marriage message anywhere else. They don't get it in the workplace. They don't get it at the bar. They don't get it at the sports stadium. You know, but at church, they get a message that tells them you're responsible to God for how you treat your family. You're responsible to God for the, you know, ultimate spiritual welfare of your children. You know, an immortal soul is at stake here in how you treat your children. And then church itself, of course, gives you activities, not just Sunday morning, but, you know, youth groups and Bible studies during the week, men's groups where they can get together with other men who actually care about their family and want to talk about that. Brad Wilcox does give us some nice language there for explaining to our non-Christian friends, you know, why church actually does have a positive impact on men. You know, it's the only place you will really get this kind of pro-marriage, pro-family discourse for men.
Well, and I just affirm that because, I mean, I had a conversation this afternoon on the phone with an older gentleman who is distraught because his children are not walking in the faith, and he is broken over that. He's not sure what to do. And so, as in my role in coaching pastors and men's ministry leaders, I tell them the softest spot in a man's heart is for his children, and to find a way to help a man do well with his children and raise up a healthy next generation. We don't want kids to peak in elementary school. I mean, the highlight of their experience should not be, I've got a honor roll student at the elementary school, but to see a bigger view of raising godly adults. And so I just so much affirm what you're saying there about the desire for fathers and church being a place where they can get those answers.
And
so thank you for that.
It is the most important long-term solution to toxic behavior in men. You know, insofar as the secular script has encouraged young men to be like Andrew Tate, right? Fast cars, yes. Fast money, fast girls. And by the way, I just heard from a former graduate student of mine who's now teaching high schoolers. And she said, all of our boys are fans of Andrew Tate. You know, they're putting his quotes in the yearbook. She teaches at a classical Christian school. I didn't expect that at a school like that. So young men are seeking out, you know, what does it mean to be a man? And what the sociologists tell us is that, you know, long term, what matters most is the relationship with his father, right? There was an award-winning study. It was a 35-year longitudinal study on how effective parents are at passing along their Christian faith. Right. And they found two things that were surprising. The first surprising thing was if a father is active in his faith, 68% of his children will follow. They will match his level of religious participation. It doesn't work that way with the mother. I don't know if they even gave us the article I read didn't even give the mothers. I think it was something like 40%. But anyway, fathers, it's 68%. So fathers matter more. And by the way, my female students don't always like hearing that. They say, you know, why shouldn't mothers matter? Well, they matter, but you know what? It's just a fact. It's a fact. Men are leaders whether they want to be or not. Men have...
That's exactly right.
Men have influence whether they want to or not. And the second thing he found is how they have influence, though. He said if a man is a pillar of the church, if he's a moral exemplar, if he has perfectly correct theology, but he's not loving, his children will not follow him in the faith. Mm. It takes a warm, loving relationship. That is the most important thing. And I was surprised, even secular research has found something similar. There was a science journalist who wrote a book on boys. And he said, the masculinity of the son does not depend on how masculine the father is. It depends on whether he has a warm, loving relationship with his father. That will make a boy more masculine. So
I was surprised to read that in your book. I found that fascinating. I think you also cited a study that I'm familiar with. I want to say it's a National Center for Fathering or the National Fatherhood Initiative that asked mothers, where could the father of their children go to get help with being a better dad? The number one answer was the local church. But most churches are not doing anything of remarkable impact in the area of fathering. And so I just think that's a missed opportunity for a lot of churches.
Isn't that, I agree with you. And what was interesting about that study, and yes, you're right, National Fatherhood Initiative, is that even women who said they were not very religious or not at all religious, they still right. said the best place is the local church. And
that's
then
right.
they asked the fathers a slightly different question. They asked them, you know, where have you gone to find help being a better dad? And about 50% of the fathers said the local church. So you're yeah. right. I like the way you put it. That's a missed opportunity. If churches aren't stepping up and doing more to nurture fathers, nurture biblical
sure.
fathers. And I say this too in the book. I think there's an important role for the churches to deal with fatherless children.
Yes.
I keep running into this number. 40% of American children are growing up apart from their natural fathers and often don't
yes.
see them at all. So, and some of them are lucky enough to have father substitutes in the home, but not most of them. America has the highest rate of single parenthood in the world. And so
yes.
one thing I say in the book is, by the way, I just got quoted in Christianity Today for this. There's an article that said, Nancy Piercy says that
there
churches should put a higher priority on ministries to fatherless boys. And then
yes.
the author said, she's absolutely right. But I make a point in the book that fatherless boys, I mean, if you care about, you know, toxic masculinity or toxic forms of it, the answer is not to go out and accuse men of being toxic. The answer is to start nurturing the next generation. And the good news is that there's been research on this, and research has found that father substitutes can have a huge impact at grandparents and other extended family, teachers, coaches, Big Brother programs, and of course, church youth group leaders. They can have a huge impact. And so it's not something that anyone needs to stand by idly and say, I can't do anything. You can step in and have an impact. Just about anybody can have an impact in helping to solve this, the boy crisis, as it's sometimes called.
Well, folks, thanks for listening to part one of our podcast interview with Professor Nancy Piercy. She's the author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. You can find her book on Amazon or wherever books are sold. You can learn more about Nancy at nancypiercy.com. We will also have links to these connections in the show notes for this podcast. There will also be a link to the Noble Warriors YouTube channel if you'd like to watch my interview with Nancy Piercy in its entirety in one session. I'm Mike Young, and you've been listening to the Noble Man Podcast. Find out more about me and the Ministry of Noble Warriors at noblewarriors.org. Be sure to check out part two of my conversation with Dr. Nancy Piercy coming up next.